we need, Kitai replied. Whatever you said to those two was effective. Could you say it again, perhaps?
Again? Isana replied.
If needed.
She nodded at the sack.
I have to get the rest of them.
And you're going to steal them? Isana asked. What if you're caught? Kitai jerked her head back as if Isana had slapped her and arched one pale, imperious eyebrow.
No Alaran in this entire senseless, pointless city has ever caught me, she said, with the perfectly steady confidence of someone telling the truth. Isana could feel that in her voice as well.
Kitai sighed.
Well, she admitted, one. But it was a special circumstance. And anyway, he's asleep right now.
Isana shook her head. I'm not certain what you think me capable of, Kitai. I believe that you are skilled at this sort of thing, but I am not. I am not sure you want me to come along.
Faster, if we can walk openly on the street, Kitai said. One woman alone will be questioned. Two women walking quickly will not be. And I cannot take the heavy bag along with me. I would have to leave it behind each time I climbed. I would feel better if it was being watched than if I had to leave it lying in some alley.
Isana studied the Marat girl for a moment, then sighed and said, Very well. With one condition. Kitai tilted her head.
Yes? I want to talk to you about Tavi as we walk.
Kitai frowned, her features concerned.
Ah. Is that considered to be appropriate, then?
Between us? Isana asked.
Yes.
It's something called girl talk. Kitai nodded as they began walking again.
What does that mean?
It means that you can speak openly and plainly to me without fear of being inappropriate, and I won't be outraged or angered by anything you tell me. Kitai gave the city around them an exasperated glance.
Finally, she said. Alarans.
Chapter 32. Amara was worried. The swamps stretched out all around them, an endless landscape of trees and water, mist and mud. Life seemed to boil from every patch of ferns, to drip from the branches of every tree. Frogs and singing insects filled the nights with a deafening racket. Birds and small animals who lived within the trees chirped and cried throughout the day. And always, day or night, the air swarmed with insects, like a constant buzzing veil that continuously had to be pushed aside. The terrain was a brutal mixture of shallow water over clinging mud, deeper water that could rise above Amara's chest, and the occasional sullen, damp, insect-infested rise of more solid earth. Twice more they were rushed by Garim, though thankfully none were as large as those lurking around the exterior of the swamp. But they ceased their rush forward when confronted with immediate resistance, and simply scattered when Bernard and Amara willed their furies into visible manifestation. The lizards, it seemed, had learned the futility of assaulting wild furies, and were quick to avoid those the trio had brought with them. They were making reasonably good time, so long as one considered that any significant progress was reasonable in the relentlessly wearying terrain. They had avoided any further mishaps, and they had found a number of edible fruits and berries growing within the swamp. They tasted foul, but would sustain life, for a time at least. The worst thing about the past several days was how the swamp had absolutely permeated her lower body. She and Bernard were both covered in the thick, rich muck of the swamp floor nearly to the hips, and constantly walking through water had ruined her boots and left her feet perpetually damp and chilled. They had to stop several times a day just to dry their feet out and prevent them from developing sores. There had been no further encounters with the enemy. All the same, Amara was worried. About Bernard. They stayed in the shelter he'd had Brutus dig for less than a day, all told. The instant he woke, he wobbled to his feet and insisted that they had to leave at once. Only the fact that it was already the dead of night and that the First Lord was still unconscious kept him from staggering into the swamps. But the instant there was light enough to see, he began preparing for the remainder of the journey. To Amara's surprise, the first thing he did was to skin the dead Garim. The soft, supple hide of their throats and bellies had already been ripped open by scavengers and gnawed by insects, and they would be useless for making capes. But the heavy, nodule-studded skin of the large lizard's backs and flanks remained sound. Bernard cut the large sections of tough leather away from the corpses and laid them flat on the ground. At a murmur from him, Brutus rose and dragged the hides down into the earth. A moment later they reappeared, the skin side of the leather scoured clean of any remaining flesh. Bernard went to a willow tree beside the swamp and drew off a dozen larger branches. Under his hands they simply came away from the trees, like grapes picked from a vine. Using his wood fury and his broad, capable hands, he bound them together into a long frame within a few moments, complete with wooden handles at either end. He then stretched the hides over the frame and secured and sealed them with thick resinous sap from another tree. 20 minutes after he began, Bernard bore what looked something like a runnerless sled over to the First Lord and loaded Gaius into it. Then, with repeated nervous glances over his shoulder, he got his bearings and led Amara into the swamps, carrying the frame over one shoulder when the ground was mostly solid, and letting Gaius float in his boat stretcher whenever they had to wade. Gaius was asleep or unconscious much of the time. Though Bernard tried to be careful, the First Lord's stretcher could not avoid every jolt and bump, and whenever it happened his face turned pale and twisted into a pained rictus. It wasn't until their second day in the swamps that Amara saw that Bernard's course had begun to waver. At first it wasn't by much, but as the days went by, Amara saw that his sighting of trees ahead and behind had become increasingly sloppy. "Stop," Amara said finally. "Bernard, let's stop for a moment. I need to rest." Bernard, who had been walking over a low hillock with the First Lord's litter over one shoulder, settled the old man down gently and sank to the ground without a protest, his head bowed. Amara frowned. He hadn't checked the ground beneath him before he sat, something he had repeatedly emphasized as important during their first day in the swamp. Such places, he warned her, harbored a great many venomous serpents and insects with poisonous bites, and it could be worth as much as a man's life to sit down upon or near one of them. Amara checked the ground around Bernard before she settled down, drew out her water bottle, and drank. She offered it to her husband. He drank as well. "I need to talk to you," she said quietly. He nodded without answering. "I've been watching, and I think your course is wavering." Bernard frowned and looked up at her. Then he muttered under his breath and asked,
"Are you sure?"
Amara bit her lower lip, met her husband's eyes, and nodded. His expression became faintly confused, and he shook his head.
"How much?"
"It's hard for me to judge. We might be 5 or 10 miles south of our original line of march." He closed his eyes for a moment, then nodded.
"I see."
She took his hand between hers. "Love, tell me what's wrong." Bernard swallowed. He shook his head once. Flies and midges buzzed noisily about them. A rare breath of wind stirred the water at the base of the little hillock and set a dozen frogs to croaking. Amara leaned closer and kept her voice gentle. "Tell me, love."
"It's my eyes," he half whispered. They're not focusing the way they should. Sometimes I have trouble trying to find the right marker to hold our course, but I thought I was getting it most of the time."
Amara felt her heart beat faster with nervous fear. "You did take a blow to the head, love. It can do things to a person's vision until they've had time to recover."
"Yes,"
Bernard said. He looked up, squinting out at the swamps, then winced and pushed the heel of his hand hard against his head. "Pain?" Amara asked. He nodded.
"Wasn't much at first, but it's the light. Everything is too bright. It hurts to move my eyes around."
Amara leaned over and placed her wrist lightly over his forehead. I've heard of some diseases that can do that, but you don't have a fever.
I feel fine, he growled, leaning a little away from her hand. Except for my bloody head.
That is generally considered to be something important, Amara said. Even for men.
Bernard smiled faintly at the joke, but didn't lift his head. If I'm not able to do this, he shook his head. If I can't trust my eyes, there's no help for it. You'll have to take the lead until this has passed.
Amara frowned. Are you sure? She asked gently. You told me that navigating through a swamp was no task for a novice.
I'm sure that we haven't got much choice, he replied. You did well enough before. Amara grimaced.
I'm not sure it will be as easy here.
No, Bernard said. It won't. So it's a good thing you've had some practice.
In the stretcher, the First Lord stirred and lifted his head. He peered blearily around them.
Still in the swamps?
Yes, sire, Amara said.
Bloody crows! I thought I remembered someone saying we were finally out of them. Have you seen the mountains yet?
No, sir, Bernard rumbled. But with the trees and the mist, we can't see more than a quarter mile or so at best.
Oh,
Gaius murmured, subsiding again.
Well, have we another blanket? I'm frozen.
Amara's head came up suddenly, and Bernard's did the same. She traded a long look with her husband. Then she went to the First Lord, who lay apparently sleeping once more. She laid her hand on his forehead and felt the fever at once. He's running a fever, she said quietly.
Bernard growled. Check his feet first. If anything got into his blood, he might have to heal it and take our chances on alerting Kalaris.
Amara used more water to clean her hands and check the First Lord's dressing. His sore foot still looked tender, the flesh red and raw, but there was no swelling or inflammation. His broken leg, bound hard to its splint, was swollen still, but the deep and heavy bruising all around it had faded to faint blotches of yellow and green. She cleaned them both with salted water, which elicited no response from the sleeping First Lord. Then she covered them again and turned to her husband.
I don't think it's come in through the wounds. Perhaps it's just a springtime fever.
Maybe, Bernard said.
He rubbed at his head again.
We need to push harder, he said quietly. Get as close as we can to Kalare, as fast as we can possibly manage it.
If he keeps getting sicker, he might not be able to craft himself out of it, Amara said quietly.
All the more reason for haste, Bernard replied.
Amara frowned, but could hardly argue with him. Their choices were unenviable. Allow Gaius to continue being weakened to ensure the surprise attack he said they needed, or have him begin fury crafting immediately when they were farthest from any support, and where even the First Lord himself might eventually be overwhelmed by enemy numbers. How much farther? Amara asked. Bernard made a brushing motion at the earth in front of them, and immediately the ground almost seemed to boil, dark loam rising to cover the grass and weeds in smooth, rich brown. Another gesture and a large, semicircular area of the dirt shifted its contours, becoming an irregular, bumpy surface, not too unlike the skin of a garum.
This is the swamp, he said quietly.
He took a small stone from the ground and placed it almost a third of the way across.
Here's us.
He gestured with his hand again, and the earth at the far side of the symbolic swamp shifted, rising up into smooth cones in a broad, elegant sweep, like that of a strung bow.
Here are the Kalare Mountains. They half encircle the area around Kalare. Once we cross the swamps, we'll have to make our way to the base of the mountains. Then we'll have to press through them until we find one close enough to see the city. Then we'll have to climb it.
Amara blew out a breath. She hadn't fully realized the implications of the distances and terrains involved. She had never fully appreciated the full meaning of her ability to fly, completely ignoring such obstacles. When one had to walk over and around and through them, travel became a completely different sort of challenge.
How long will it take us?
Under ideal circumstances, maybe 2 weeks to the edge of the swamps and another day of fast travel to the pass through the mountains. Like this?
Bernard shook his head.
3. Maybe more.
Amara's heart sank.
3 weeks or more of this?
She wriggled her toes in her boots, or at least tried to. They were so damp and chilled she wasn't sure that they'd moved at all.
Oh, she said quietly.
You can't think of it like that, Bernard said.
Like what?
He gestured at the swamp.
As 3 more weeks of this.
Then how should I think of it? Amara asked wearily.
One thing at a time, Bernard said. For instance, right now what we need to do is stand up.
Her husband suited action to his words, wearily pushing himself to his feet. He offered her his hand. Amara took it and rose.
Good, Bernard said.
He pointed out to her the last 2 trees he'd used.
Now find your mark.
Amara did, lining up the 2 trees and sighting forward to her next waypoint, correcting their course slightly back to the north.
All right.
Bernard grunted and picked up the stretcher again.
Now we go to your next mark.
He glanced up at the sky, and though the sun was hidden by clouds and mist, he winced and shielded his eyes with one hand.
We just keep doing that. Walking to the next tree.
Amara took a deep breath, studying her husband, fearing for him. Blows to the head could take days or weeks to kill a man. What if he'd been more badly wounded than he claimed? What if he was already bleeding inside his skull, and it was only a matter of time before the pressure killed him? Gaius could heal such an injury. She bit her lip. She was a curser of the First Lord. He had given her a task, and it was her duty to see it through. Even if it cost her life. Even if it cost Bernard's life. The thought made Amara's knees feel suddenly weak with dread, and simultaneously brought up a burst of anger that burned in her chest. Had she not already done enough? Had she not already given more than enough? She had fought the Crown's enemies tooth and bloody nail. She had overcome creatures of nightmare and men of cruel and destructive means as a curser, and her body bore more than one scar received in the line of duty. Had she not done enough for the First Lord that he would ask her to sacrifice the man she loved, too? It would be easy to stop. She had only to tell Gaius that his fever demanded him to take action to save his own life. Or if that was not enough, it would be laughably simple to ensure that an infection spread to his wound. All she had to do was be careless for a moment with a single cleaning, a single slip of the bandages. Gaius could heal himself, heal Bernard, and they could all leave this hideous place. She thought for a moment of a lifetime without Bernard, without ever again knowing his touch, hearing his voice, without ever again sleeping beside him, waking in the circle of his arms, knowing beyond any doubt that she was desired, treasured, loved. Her husband touched her chin with gentle fingers, and she looked up at him. His eyes, though shadowed with pain, were almost invasively aware. She had no doubt at all that he had guessed the direction of her thoughts.
"What do I do?" she whispered.
He was silent for a moment before he rumbled,
"What your heart tells you is right. As always."
She bowed her head, feeling the burn of impotent, shamed tears in her eyes. She refused, absolutely refused, to let them fall. She looked up at him again and said,
"We'll walk to the next tree."
Chapter 33 Tavi looked up at the evening sky and grimaced at the cheerily shining stars. He would have preferred pitch darkness for the raid. Such conditions made it virtually impossible for any kind of organized activity. But considering that Kitai could see in the dark, His own small group would have been at far less of a disadvantage than the forces of the Civic Legion, the Grey Guard, and any other troops who might be in position in the capital. Granted, the deceptive shadows and sourceless glow of starlight could be worse than pure darkness when it came to aiming at a target, but Tavi would vastly have preferred a night so Stygian as to prevent him from becoming a target in the first place.
"Staring out the window isn't going to make the time pass any more quickly," Aaron observed.
Tavi turned from the window of his room at the boarding house and gave Aaron a very direct look.
"I'm just saying," Aaron said, spreading his hands.
Tavi sighed and paced over to his bed. It was after midnight, and the rest of the house had been asleep for hours. Araris was stretched out on one bed, fully dressed, snoozing. Aaron, in his chair by the door, was patiently sewing a new hem on one of the evening's disguises, his needle moving smoothly and steadily. Tavi sat down on the bed, drew his sword from its scabbard, and got out his whetstone. He spat on it and began stroking the sword's edge with focused, deliberate movements. After a little while, Araris turned his head, opened one eye, and said to Tavi,
"Give over, man. If it isn't sharp by now, it's never going to be."
"All this criticism had better not be setting a pattern for the evening," Tavi growled.
Araris turned to Aaron and said,
"Don't take any offense, Sir Aaron. He's always been the sort to start running his mouth when he gets worried about something. It usually got him into one kind of trouble or another."
"I know what you mean," Aaron responded. "There was this one time in class during our final examination."
Tavi let out a disgusted sigh and rose.
"I'm going to see if the ladies need anything."
He strode to the door, ignoring Aaron's grin, and went to the room down the hall. He knocked quietly and said,
"It's me."
Isana opened the door, smiling.
"Come in, dear."
Tavi returned her smile and hoped it didn't look as tense as he felt.
"Thank you."
Inside the room, Kitai sat cross-legged on the floor, dressed in dark, closely fit clothing. She was carefully coiling a slender rope. She looked up at Tavi and smiled.
"Chala, is it time to leave already?"
"Not yet," Tavi admitted.
"Then why are you here?" she asked.
Tavi scowled.
"Aaron and Fade didn't like the way I was running my mouth."
Kitai put down her rope, stared at him for a second. Then she turned to Isana. There was another moment of silence, and both of them burst out into
giggles.
Kitai and Isana, his mother, were giggling. He blinked at them for a moment, then scowled more deeply and demanded,
"What?"
Their giggles became a regular gale of bubbling laughter, and Isana actually had to sit down on the bed. Tavi felt his scowl deepen.
"Tonight is hardly a laughing matter."
They laughed themselves breathless, and as Tavi grew more frustrated, a single glance at him was enough to send them into fresh bursts of merriment. It wasn't until Isana sat with her eyes pressed against her stomach and tears in her eyes that it finally began to die down.
"I'm glad someone's enjoying themselves tonight," Tavi said. "Is everything ready?"
"I believe so," Isana said, her voice still quavering slightly. "All the pieces of your plan are ready to go, Aleran," Kitai said, nodding. "Not that there is much point in all this preparation."
"Oh?" Tavi asked. "Why not?"
"Because it will not work out the way you expect," she said calmly.
Tavi frowned at her.
"You've seen the plans, the guards' positions, the defenses. If you thought it wasn't going to work, why didn't you say anything yesterday?"
"The plan is good," Kitai said. "You did not miss anything."
"Then why would you think it's going to go wrong?"
"Because it always does."
Kitai smiled at him.
"It is the nature of life. Something unexpected happens. Something goes wrong and the plan must change."
"If that happens," Tavi said, emphasizing the first word very slightly, "then we'll adapt."
"Tell me this," Kitai said. "In your plans, why did you not tell us what Varg was going to do?"
Tavi grimaced at her. There's no way of knowing, he said. I think he'll cooperate, but...
Kitai nodded her head in satisfaction, gathered up her coils of rope, and put them in a leather case on her belt. Just so long as you know that tonight will not go to plan.
Pessimist, Tavi said.
Tavi, Isana said, were the cold stones sufficient? He still couldn't believe that his mother had helped Kitai burgle a dozen restaurants in the dead of night.
They should be, he said. I'm more worried about the armor. It's close, but it isn't perfect.
One can hardly expect to acquire custom-made counterfeit suits of armor in 2 days, Kitai replied. Not even here in the capital.
I know, but...
Tavi sighed.
There's no way we're getting inside once the alarm is raised.
We have made the best preparations we can, Alaren, she told him. There is no sense in letting it worry you at this point.
Probably, he said.
But you will worry anyway, she sighed. Perhaps it isn't entirely his fault, Isana murmured. I'm afraid it's a habit he learned from me. She faced Tavi and her expression became much more serious. But she's right, dear. Worry is fear in disguise, and fear will eat you from the inside out if you let it. She gave him a faint smile. Believe me, I know. Tavi took a deep breath and exhaled heavily. If anyone in all of Alara had good reason to worry and fear, surely he was that person. At the same time, though, he recognized good advice when he heard it. He might not be able to follow it, but it would probably be smart to try, at least in the long term.
I'll try, he said dryly, but not tonight. I've got enough on my mind without adding more pressure.
Isana smiled at him and nodded. We'll be ready to go when it's time, she told him. Kitai snorted as she rummaged through a second belt case, laying out several tools in a neat row. Only if there isn't someone here distracting us with foolish conversation about things he cannot change. Tavi was about to say something about the two of them not liking the way he ran his mouth either, but thought better of it. Of all the things he expected to face tonight, paralytic fits of laughter at his expense had been rather low on the list.
We'll go as soon as Eren's done with the cloaks.
He nodded to both of them and paced back down the hall to his room. When he entered, Araris was standing in the middle of the floor, his body shrouded by a long grey cloak.
Are you sure it isn't going to hang too low? He said. Cloaks look very fine, but they're impractical enough to fight in without making them long enough to trip yourself on, too.
It'll be another 4 or 5 inches higher once you've got the armor on, Eren assured him. He glanced up at Tavi and tossed him a second grey cloak rolled into a bundle. This seems a little familiar. Try it on. Tavi unfurled the cloak and donned it. Eren came over to inspect the hem, which hung halfway down his shins. Not bad. Not quite uniform length, but it should pass in the dark.
Right, Tavi said.
Outside, the city's bells struck a single note, as they did for each hour between sunset and dawn.
Midnight.
All right, Tavi said.
He seized his pack.
Let's go.
The first part of the plan was, in some ways, the most dangerous. The Grey Tower was a nondescript sort of building, utterly lacking in the drama its name and role in history implied. It did not look particularly menacing. For that matter, it hardly looked like a tower. It was an unassuming stone building of several stories. There was an institutional look to the square structure, with its even, identical rows of windows that spoke more of regularity and economy than of style or art. There was a wide green lawn around the building, devoid of any decoration and easily watched. For centuries, the Grey Tower had served an important role in Alaran society, as the sole prison in the realm capable of holding the upper strata of the citizenry captive against their will. There were furies forged into the very rock of the tower, fused into each cell by dozens of the most potently gifted fury crafters in the realm for the sole purpose of neutralizing the crafting of the tower's prisoners. In addition to its protective furies, the tower was also home to the Grey Guard,
a half-century of knights ferrous recruited specifically for the quality of their character and their loyalty to the realm. Indeed, there was even a crown law on the books that required the crown to pay any guardsman offered a bribe 3 times the offered amount when the guardsman turned in the person responsible for the attempt. In its centuries of duty, not one single grey guardsman had ever accepted a bribe. All of which meant that there would be no relatively easy escape from the Grey Tower, as there had been from the stockade at the Elenarch's fortifications. In point of fact, no prisoner had ever escaped the Grey Tower, until Tavi and Kitai had overcome the inward-focused defences of the tower and its personnel, and extracted Antilla Maximus from his cell during the Vord attack several years past. At that time there had been little evidence of traditional prison accoutrements. There had been no bars, no gates, and no walls around the grounds. Since then, things had changed. The first obstacle Tavi had to overcome was the 15-foot wall around the outside perimeter of the lawn. It was 2 feet thick and made of the same interwoven layers of stone that comprised the siege walls of legion fortresses. The wall's top was coated in a layer of razor-sharp stone protrusions and dotted with sculptures of tiny owls the size of a man's hand. Gargoyles. Gargoyles were fairly common guardian furies, often used in the fortresses and residences of the rich and powerful, and though their appearance could vary greatly, they all had one thing in common. They were built to be large, powerful, and intimidating. The cost in effort and furycraft needed to maintain a gargoyle meant that they were expensive to keep, and since the Grey Tower was a state institution, economy was a constant consideration. It had been Tavi's idea to employ a greater number of weaker furies. For an effort comparable to the work needed to maintain a single gargoyle, the wall, also Tavi's suggestion, could be completely surrounded with fury-crafted sentinels. The owls were not intended to be creatures of violence, as most gargoyles were. They were simply there to raise a shrieking alarm should anyone attempt to climb the wall. All of which meant that the only way to get into the grounds, other than flying in or somehow vaulting the wall, was through its manned and guarded gate, which opened for no one but the Grey Guard and those couriers and legal personnel who carried a special authorization from the Crown itself. That was why Tavi, Eren, and Araris headed for the docks. Tavi led them into a darkened alley just off a street lined with taverns and wine clubs.
"Are you sure about this?" Araris murmured.
"I used to go to the tower every week to play Ludus with Varg," Tavi murmured as he unbelted his sword. "I got to know most of the guardsmen. The men they pick for that job don't like to change their routine. Karras and Gert will be along any time now."
Araris took off his own sword belt and set it aside.
"What if the schedule has changed?"
"It hasn't," Eren said. "I spread a little money around. They have standing weekly reservations at the Scarlet Lantern."
"Karras thinks he's a wine connoisseur," Tavi said. "Well, whenever he isn't too drunk to pronounce the word. Gert likes the dancers there."
Tavi frowned faintly. It made him more than a little uncomfortable to contemplate what he was about to do. He'd been on pleasant speaking terms with them. The two men were loyal servants to the realm, and had always been courteous with Tavi, then a scrawny young page well short of his full growth. What he was about to do seemed a poor way to repay their fidelity and respect. Eren peered around the corner of the alleyway.
"Tavi."
Tavi eased up and looked out onto the street. Fury lamps were less frequent in this part of town than in the rest of the city, but he could see well enough to identify the two grey guardsmen walking with the careful, steady steps of men who had been enjoying a few well-earned cups on their evening of leave. Tavi beckoned Araris. The Singulare moved silently to Tavi's side and passed him a small sack, weighted with gravel.
"Drunk or not," Araris said, "they're knights ferrous. If they get a chance to draw their blades, these blackjacks aren't going to be of much help.
And if we go after them with swords on our belts, they could feel the metal coming in plenty of time to draw.
Tavi countered. Araris glanced over his shoulder at his sword, leaning against a wall.
I don't like it.
If it came down to a contest of blades, we'd have to kill them, Tavi said.
I'm not willing to do that. They won't feel the same way about us, Araris said. No guard or civic legionare alive is willing to tolerate an attack by footpads.
Then we'd better get it right the first time. He glanced at the men coming toward them. They would pass the mouth of the alley in another moment,
shh, Tavi murmured,
and crouched in the thickest portion of shadows. A moment later, footsteps approached the alley. The two men walked steadily past. One of them, probably Karas, let out a rumbling belch. Then they were past the alley and continuing on down the street. Tavi rose from his crouch and stole silently after them. He couldn't hear them, but he knew Eren and Araris were at his back. Tavi took the taller man, Karas, as Araris stole up behind Gert. Tavi traded a look with the Singulare and they closed the last few steps together. Tavi swung the blackjack with all the strength of his arms and shoulders, and it slammed solidly into the base of Karas's skull and the top of his neck. The man dropped to the ground like a wet blanket. Araris swung at Gert, but whether it was because of some small sound that betrayed his presence or because of the Grey Guardsman's instincts, Gert flinched at the last second and only staggered under the blow. Gert's sword hissed from its scabbard even as he staggered, off balance. Araris pressed in to strike again, but a wobbling thrust of the guardsman's sword forced Araris to dodge, spoiling the attack. Gert, wobbling but still on his feet, turned and slashed at Tavi, forcing the young man to leap back. Nearly panicked, Tavi flung the blackjack at Gert's head, hoping to distract the man's attention from Araris, but the guardsman's blade slashed through the leather sack, spilling its contents onto the cobblestones. Then he whirled and pressed the attack on Araris. At least he did so until Eren all but flew out of the shadows. The little cursor bounded into the air, body twisting as he did, one foot lashing out in a kick driven by the speed and strength of his whole body. The kick struck Gert just above his right ear and nearly flung the man to the street. He landed in a boneless heap. Tavi felt a dizzying surge of relief.
Good work, Eren. Come on.
He seized Karas while Araris and Eren grabbed Gert, and they dragged the two unconscious men into the alley. Eren uncovered a small fury lamp, and they bound and gagged both men. Once that was done, they paced down the alley to where they had cached what they would need for the rest of the evening. Tavi had donned his armor so often now that he hardly needed to think about it as he put it on. The counterfeit armor of the Grey Guard, though, was subtly different in design than Legion's standard Lorica, and it took him a frustrating moment longer to get it fastened on. Once that was done, he buckled on his sword and donned his grey cloak, one almost identical to those of the two men on the alley floor. Eren passed him a bottle of wine. Tavi swallowed a gulp or two, splashed more of it onto his armor and cloak, and passed the bottle to Araris, who did the same. They pulled up the hoods and turned to Eren.
Well? Tavi asked.
Eren studied them critically and nodded.
Pretty good.
Let's go, Tavi said.
They followed the route Karas and Gert would have used to return to the tower, shadowed by Eren. The little cursor dogged their footsteps until they came within sight of the tower, at which point he disappeared.
Relax your knees a little, Tavi murmured to Araris. You don't look drunk enough. Not everyone's had cursor training, Araris replied.
But he did as Tavi said, and they approached the gate.
"Who's that?"
called the on-duty guard in sleepy challenge.
Tavi recognized the voice of Tiberius, another of the guardsmen he knew, and he did his best to imitate Karas's voice.
"Come on, Tib," he slurred. "You know who it is."
"About time," Tiberius replied, yawning.
"Hold on."
He appeared behind the gates, holding a ring of keys. He shambled up sleepily and unlocked the gates. The instant they were unlocked, Tavi slammed the gate open, hard. It struck Tiberius on the forehead, and he staggered back.
Tarvi closed on him before the expression of shocked surprise faded and struck him once, then twice across the jaw with his closed fists. Tiberius rocked back and forth under the pair of blows, then seemed simply to deflate. He sank slowly to the ground. Tarvi winced, shaking his right hand, while Arara seized Tiberius and hauled him into the guardhouse and out of sight. Tarvi closed the gate and locked it, then took the heavy ring of keys. He turned and started walking toward the entrance of the tower proper, and Araris fell into step beside him. They crossed the lawn and walked through the front door of the Grey Tower. Most of the Grey Guard would be asleep now, Tarvi knew. A handful of men were on duty, stationed at each floor currently occupied by a prisoner, but not on the stairs themselves. Tarvi and Araris went swiftly up the staircase. There were candle-sized fury lamps alight at each landing, and they moved as quietly as they could through the dim light until they reached the floor with Varg's cell. A single guard was on duty in the alcove in the hall adjoining the stairs, an earnest-looking young man Tarvi didn't recognize. He sat at a table, writing what looked like a letter. "Is it two already?" the man asked absently. "I thought the midnight bell just..." The young guardsman looked up. His eyes flicked between Tarvi and Araris and suddenly widened. He pushed his chair back and began to rise, his mouth opening. Araris closed the distance before the young guard could stand, his blade appearing in his hand. He lashed out with the pommel, and that guardsman too went down in a heap, his armor clattering. Tarvi stepped over to the stairs, listening for any outcry, but the sound evidently had not traveled down the stone stairway. He let out his breath slowly and nodded to Araris. "All right," he said. "I'll go get him. Then we'll..." Somewhere in the building a bell began to ring in a rapid toll of alarm. Tarvi's heart leapt into his throat. "What happened?" he demanded. "What the crows happened? What did we miss?" Voices cried out somewhere on the staircase below them. A series of rumbling clanks rippled through the building as the newly installed steel portcullises began to slam down all throughout the building, sealing it off from the outside world. There was a rumble above him, and Tarvi barely managed to throw himself forward into the hallway leading to the prison cells before several hundred pounds of steel grating plunged down from overhead and slammed to the floor. He turned and stared at the gate, now separating him from Araris and the stairway. "It doesn't matter what we missed," Araris said. He flicked his sword in a little circle as if loosening his wrist, picked up the sword of the unconscious guardsman and stepped out onto the stairway. "Go get the carne. I'll hold the stairs." Tarvi nodded, turned, and rushed down the hall toward Varg's cell, while the cries of the Grey Guard grew louder. The alarm kept ringing, and the sound of many booted feet striking stone rose up the stairway. Chapter 34. Varg's cell was a spacious chamber that could fairly be called a suite. The ceilings were high enough even for the 10-foot carne to stand erect if he wished, and the cell was divided into a living area, a bedroom, and small dining area. As Tarvi approached, the rust and musk scent of the carne bombarded his senses, bringing back the memories of his regular visits with Varg, as well as the memories of the Carnim ambassador's actions during the initial assault of the Vord Queen. Tarvi approached the darkened cell, but he couldn't see Varg. Shadows hid most of the suite, but even so it was difficult to believe that the enormous carne could have hidden himself. The bed, Tarvi thought, was unoccupied, but he couldn't be certain. He certainly had no intention of opening the door until after he'd spoken to Varg. He might have been on fairly good terms with the carne for an Aleran, but Tarvi had no illusions. Varg was not his friend. If he thought that the situation might present him an opportunity to escape, and that he could do so by killing Tarvi, the carne would do it. He might regret the necessity in retrospect, but that wouldn't slow the carne's claws or fangs for an instant. Tarvi stopped at the door and called, "Varg! It's Tarvi of Calderon. I would speak with you." In the shadows near the suite's hearth, two flickering gleams of scarlet appeared. A breath later, the shadows stirred, and the enormous shape of the Carne stepped forward into what little light came in from the hall. Varg looked like something out of a nightmare. Huge, even by the standards of the Carnum, he stood nearly 10 feet tall. He had fur of darkest black, but it was crisscrossed with so many fine streaks of white, where the fur had grown up through the Carne's battle scars, that in the right light his fur looked almost grey. One of his ears was notched, and a glistening red jewel carved into the shape of a human skull dangled from a gold ring in it. His eyes, black irises against fields of blood red, studied Tavi with an amused intelligence, and despite his size, he moved as nimbly as a cat as he prowled across the suite to face Tavi. Tavi leaned his head slightly to one side, exposing the side of his throat. It was a bit of Carnim body language similar to a human nod, and Varg returned the gesture, though he did not tilt his head so far as Tavi had.
"You have grown," Varg growled.
The Carne's voice was a snarling basso, and his words were mangled by his fangs on the way out of his throat, but his Alaran was perfectly intelligible.
"This alarm is your doing, I take it."
"Yes," Tavi said. "I want you to come with me."
Varg tilted his head.
"Why?"
"There is little time for talk," Tavi said. Varg's eyes narrowed, but his tail flicked in a gesture Tavi had come to understand as an implied agreement.
"Do you act for your First Lord in this?"
"I act to protect his interests," Tavi said.
"But you do this at his bidding?"
Varg pressed.
"Our people have a phrase, sir. It is easier to secure forgiveness than permission."
Varg's ears flicked in amusement.
"Ah. What are your intentions for me?"
"I intend to get you out of this prison," Tavi said. "Then smuggle you out of the city. Then I will take you to the coast and return you to the commander of the Carnim army who invaded 2 years ago. Hopefully I'll be able to stop our people from tearing one another apart by doing so."
Varg's chest rumbled with a low growl.
"Who leads my people in your land?"
"The warrior Nasorg," Tavi said.
Varg's ears suddenly swiveled toward Tavi, so alert that they quivered.
"Nasorg is in Alera."
Tavi nodded. "He offered to discuss a cessation of hostilities if you were returned to your people. I have come to do that." Varg paced closer to the bars.
"Tell me," he growled, "why I should trust you."
"You shouldn't," Tavi said. "I am your enemy, and you are mine. But by sending you back to your people, I help my own. Gadara or not, I need you returned to them, alive and healthy." Varg's chest rumbled suddenly.
"Gadara. You did not learn that word from me."
"No," Tavi said. "It is what Nasorg called me."
Steel suddenly rang on steel down the hallway, and flashes of colored light splashed onto the walls of the hallway, where the swords of metal crafters clashed on the stairs. Tavi gritted his teeth and turned back to Varg.
"Do you want out of this hole or not?"
Varg bared his teeth in his imitation of an Alaran smile.
"Open the door."
"First," Tavi said, "I will have your word."
Varg tilted his head.
"I'm the one who is getting you out of here, and I can't do it without your cooperation. If I let you out, you become part of my pack. If I tell you to do something, you do it, no questions or arguing, and I will have your word that you will do no harm to my people while you travel with me."
A scream echoed down the hall. There was a brief pause, then the flickering lights and steely chimes of swordplay resumed. Varg stared at Tavi for what seemed like a week, though it could not have been more than a few seconds.
"You lead," he growled. "I follow, until you are unworthy of it."
Tavi bared his teeth. "That is insufficient."
"It is the oath my pack swears to me," Varg said. "I am Carnim. I will stay in this hole and rot before I become something I am not."
Tavi closed his mouth again and nodded once. "But I will have your promise to do no harm to my people until you are returned to your own."
Agreed, Varg said. I will keep my word so long as you keep yours.
Done, Tavi said. This was the tricky part. Varg had never lied to Tavi, as far as the young man knew, but Tavi thought it more than a little possible that Varg might sacrifice his personal honor if he deemed it necessary to serve his people. Varg would never be able to escape Alera without help, and Tavi thought him smart enough to realize that. But Varg had shown him more than once that the Khanim did not think the way Alerans did. Varg might have different thoughts than Tavi on the subject of his escape. But there was no sense in backing out now. Tavi thrust the key into the cell's door and unlocked it, opening it for Varg. He backed away as 700 pounds of fang, fur, and muscle squeezed sideways through the cell door. Once free, Varg crouched, to put his eyes on level with Tavi's. Then deliberately he bowed his head to one side, more deeply than he had before. Tavi returned the gesture, instinctively making his own motion shallower, and Varg flicked his ears in satisfaction.
I follow, Gadara.
Tavi nodded once. This way, he said, and strode back down the hallway. The hairs on the back of his neck rose as he turned away from the Khane. If Varg intended to betray him, he would do it now. A low coughing grunt, the Khanim equivalent of laughter, came from behind Tavi.
No, Gadara, Varg growled. The time to kill you has not yet come.
Tavi glanced over his shoulder and gave Varg an exasperated scowl. How very reassuring! Tavi drew his own sword as they reached the stairway and found Araris fighting to hold the landing. Two men in the armor of the Grey Guard were down, being hauled away by their companions, but the rest were dressed in little more than their breeches, their hair mussed from sleep. Most of the guardsmen had been sound asleep when the alarm sounded, and had simply seized their blades and come running. Now three men faced Araris, though they had to stand sideways on the stairs, pressed together in the tight space. They were fighting cautiously, and while they could not manage to break through Araris's defense without exposing their unarmored flesh to his blades, Araris could not get close enough to strike one without being faced with the two blades of his companions.
"We're ready," Tavi shouted. "Go, go," Araris said. "Hurry, get clear."
Tavi turned to face the steel portcullis and closed his eyes for a second or two, concentrating. He felt his awareness spread into the sword in his hand, and he could sense the air moving around it, as if it had been his own hand. He focused on that awareness, reaching out to the blade's timeless spirit, and poured his own effort and will into the steel, strengthening and sharpening it. He let out a shout and struck at the portcullis, sure that the fury-enhanced blade would be able to cut them free within several strokes. A virtual hurricane of sparks flew up where the blade contacted the portcullis, scarlet and blue and violet all mixed together, and Tavi felt the shock of impact lance up through the sword's blade and into his arm. It hurt, as if he'd slammed his unprotected fist into a brick wall, and he let out a snarl of pain. The bars of the portcullis had not been severed. One of them evinced a slight gouge, but other than that, Tavi may as well have struck the fury-crafted steel with a willow branch.
"They improved it,"
Tavi hissed, clutching at the wrist of his sword arm with his left hand. "They crafted the portcullis. I can't cut it."
"I'm a little busy here," Araris snapped. "Do something."
Tavi nodded once and sheathed his sword. The new gates, once dropped, had been fitted with a crafting that closed the stone behind them, so that there was no way to lift them again. They were simply locked into the stone around them and could not be moved until the building's furies were persuaded to open the stone above the gates once more. They could not be raised again, but that did not necessarily mean that they could not be moved. Tavi seized the portcullis with both hands, planted his feet, and reached down into the stone beneath him. He drew upon that steady, constant strength and felt it flooding up into him through his legs, hips, spreading over his chest and into his shoulders and arms. He gathered in as much of that power as he could, then gritted his teeth and heaved at the steel grate, attempting to wrench it free of the stone around it by sheer brute force. The gate's steel might have been crafted to resist the impact of fury-enhanced blades, but that didn't mean it could not be bent by power applied in a different way. The steel flexed slightly and quivered as Tavi pulled. It began to warp a little, no more than an inch or so. Then Tavi found himself gasping, unable to sustain the effort. His breath exploded out of his lungs in a gasp, and the flexible steel of the grate flexed almost entirely back into its original shape. Its deformation was barely visible. A huge, furred arm nudged Tavi gently aside, and Varg stepped up to the grate. The Carne narrowed his eyes, spreading his long arms out to grip the grate at one corner at its top and the opposite corner at its bottom. Then he settled his feet, snarled, and wrenched at the grate. For a second, nothing happened. Muscles corded and twisted beneath the Carne's thick fur, quivering with effort. Then Varg let out a roar of effort, and his hunched, powerful shoulders jerked. There was a scream of tortured rock, and then the fury-crafted stone wall of the hallway itself shattered. Pieces of stone went flying as the Carne ripped the steel grate clear of its stone frame. Varg snarled, tilted the grate to get through the doorway to the stairs, and without preamble flung it over Araris's head and down upon the guardsman on the stairs. Varg hadn't thrown it with any particular force, but the grate weighed several hundred pounds if it weighed an ounce, and it fell flat upon the unarmored guardsman like some enormous fly-swatter, pressing the struggling men down and pinning them. Araris blinked at the grate, then at the Carne, his mouth opening slightly. "Come on," Tavi snapped, "before they get loose. We're leaving." The Grey Tower's enhanced defenses had been designed to prevent anyone from leaving, but the logic behind its layout assumed that an escaping prisoner would run for the only exit, the front door. Now that the windows were covered with heavy bars, the only way out was through the front door, and the building's security plans had been designed to make it impossible for a prisoner to descend the stairway and exit the building. The heavy portcullis gates isolated each level of the prison from the stairway, and more cut the stairway off from the rest of the building, while still more heavy grates sealed the building's only exit, several floors below. Which was why Tavi flung himself onto the stairs and sprinted up them, toward the roof. He fervently hoped that Kitai and Asana's portion of the plan hadn't gone as badly wrong as theirs had, or this evening was going to come to an early, painful, and spectacularly bloody conclusion. Chapter 35 Kitai's head whipped around as the alarm bells in the Grey Tower began to ring. She paced over to the edge of the rooftop, peered at the tower, and snorted. "I told him so. You were there." Isana hurried to Kitai's side. The younger woman stared intently at the Grey Tower and shook her head. "We must hurry." "What's happening?" Isana asked. Kitai seized her pack, shrugged into it, and jogged toward the other side of the building. "Someone is ringing bells." Isana bit down on a sharp retort and instead hurried after Kitai. "More specific, please." "They went inside only moments ago and the alarm has been raised. The tower's defenses and guards have been alerted. They can only get out from the roof, and they must escape quickly if they are to escape at all, which means we must hurry." She lifted a hand and pressed it gently against Isana's chest. "Wait here," the Marat woman said. Then she took a pair of steps, her legs blurring with sudden haste, and flung herself off the top of the building. She bounded gracefully through the air a full 20 feet or more and landed on the top of the aqueduct that coursed through this part of the city and passed near the Grey Tower. Kitai turned as if she did such things every day and promptly produced one of the coiled ropes from the case at her belt. She flung one end, lariat-style, across the gap between the rooftop and the aqueduct, and Isana caught it. She blinked up at Kitai. "What do I do with it?"
"Slip one foot through the loop, like a horse's stirrup," Kitai said. "Hold tight with both hands, then step off the building."
Isana blinked. She glanced over the rooftop's edge. It was a 7-story building, and a fall to the street below would be quite sufficient to crush the life from a woman of far more youth and agility than she. She said. And then what?
Kitai put an impatient hand